Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled The End of Deference, How States Are Leading a Sometimes Quiet Revolution Against an Administrative Deference Doctrines. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have Daniel Ortner, who is an attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will then open up the floor for an audience Q&A portion. Thank you for sharing with us today. Daniel, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about this topic today. So at the federal level, as I think we all are aware, the question of deference, a lot of attention over the past years. Many sitting members of the Supreme Court, especially Justice Thomas, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, and others have expressed a great amount of skepticism about Chevron and Kaiser deference. They've argued that this kind of deference is incompatible with the idea of the rule of law. Other members of the judiciary on the courts of appeals have also issued very scathing indubitante or concurring or dissenting opinions criticizing these deference doctrines. But so far, the Supreme Court has not shown really any appetite for dramatically scaling back deference. Just last year, they had an opportunity to do so in the Kaiser case for Seminole Rock or our deference, which is deference to an agency's interpretation of its own regulations. But the court, I think, unfortunately, did not do so. It did issue some very valuable limitations on application of our or Seminole Rock deference. It clarified that it is a deference, a doctrine of last resort that has to be first significant statutory interpretation. It said, emphasize that these interpretations can't be ad hoc or made up on the fly as a litigating position. So there's some very valuable limitations in the Kaiser decision, but it did not dramatically scale back deference. And we'll have to see what effect that decision has in the lower courts. At the same time, there's been a less appreciated revolution in the state courts that has gotten a lot less attention. So my purpose here today is to discuss that what I call a quiet revolution that's happened in the states in rejecting deference, and this has been a pretty wide scale rejection. There have been ten states that have expressly rejected deference. One of them is longstanding. Delaware has long rejected deference, but of all the other states, all nine of them, it's been since 2008, and really just in the past 3-4 years, most of them have really began that process. Just a month ago, Arkansas joined that group. So this is an ongoing process of states deciding to reject deference, either our or Chevron deference or both. And even in the states that haven't done so, there's been a shift away from deference. In many states, there are some types of deference are recognized, but others are not. In also a large number of states, even if they're still embracing deference, they've grown more skeptical, either through employing more rigorous statutory review, which limits the field of deference, or there are noted voices of dissent on their state Supreme Courts and courts of appeal. So I want to go through that, discuss some of the trends, and then discuss a little bit what this tells us about deference and the chances, the potential for reform of deference. So there are eight states that have gotten rid of deference judicially. And I mentioned Delaware, I'm not going to talk much about because Delaware has long rejected deference. But of the other states are Arkansas, Kansas, Michigan, Mississippi, Utah, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. This trend began in 2008 with the Michigan Supreme Court, which rejected the call to adopt Chevron deference and emphasized that this the kind of unyielding deference of Chevron conflicted with the separation of powers principles and the idea that the judiciary is required to construe statutes that are issued by another branch of government. The Wyoming and Kansas Supreme Court followed suit pretty shortly thereafter. And then the Utah Supreme Court. I was actually a clerk on the Utah Supreme Court when one of these anti-deference decisions were issued, written by Justice Thomas Lee. And there's a series of decisions there, more and more restrictive, emphasizing the importance of the court, that the judiciary has the important role of deciding what is the law, and that the interpretation is ultimately a judicial function. All of these decisions really are harking onto a very similar theme. I really like what the Wisconsin Supreme Court said. They said no aspect of the judicial power is more fundamental than the judiciary's exclusive responsibility to exercise judgment in cases and controversies arising under the law. A lot of them are quoting Marbury v. Madison. It is the prerogative of the judiciary to say what law is. A lot of these decisions really are embracing the idea that it is for the courts to decide. The deference, especially binding deference, takes the court away from the role that the state constitutions envision for the courts. So it's a really encouraging trend. And as I mentioned, Arkansas just issued a decision just in April along the same lines. It emphasized that there is a risk of giving core judicial powers to executive agencies, and that would be in violation of the constitutional separation of powers. It effectively transfers the job of interpreting the law from the judiciary to the executive, and that was improper. At the same time, there have been a number of states that have rejected deference through statute or through constitutional amendment. Florida rejected deference through a constitutional amendment in 2018, and Florida is really one of the most significant states that has done so. It was before 2018 one of the more deferential states, really robust form of deference, very much binding, very deferential, and it went after this amendment overnight to being a state where deference is rejected. And a pretty dramatic shift for Florida. You already at least see some impact of it. I think there need to be some, I hope it see studies about what impact this has had in Florida, but already there were at least a few high profile decisions where the courts likely would have come out differently had there still been deference on the books. So it's really an encouraging sign, change in Florida. Wisconsin passed a law after the state Supreme Court already issued a decision, and so there's less you can draw from that change at the legislative level, but it still shows that it's encouraging that the legislator embraced the principles that were put forward by the judiciary. And then Arizona passed a very robust anti-deference law, spearheaded by the Goldwater Institute. Very encouraging change there. Fits really well with Arizona's and judicial climate, but it's a very valuable change as well. Really encouraging. There's some other states where there have been proposals to eliminated deference legislatively. So far, there hasn't been some success, but I'm optimistic that additional states will pick up this anti-deference banner for future legislative sessions. So in addition to states that have rejected deference altogether, worth mentioning that there are at least two states, North Carolina and West Virginia, that have always applied just Skidmore deference. So not binding deference, but giving agencies just the deference that is due to their weight and their wisdom and expertise. So at least some states have never really deferred. They've always just done done Skidmore-like deference. So in addition to these states, there are a large number of states that embrace some types of deference, but not other types of deference. For instance, states that have our deference only, Seminole Rock, our Kaiser deference only, but not Chevron-like deference. These states, the judiciary argues that the agencies know best what their own regulations say, and therefore their voice on that question should be binding. But essentially, they don't have any expertise, any special knowledge into what the legislator intended or by the word statute, and so that is a function for the judiciary. It's surprising to me that was the result. There were these five states that had that policy, but no states that had Chevron-like deference, but not our-like deference. At the federal level, it seems like our Seminole Rock deference, Kaiser deference, is more often questioned by the judiciary and by academic scholars. Surprised that wasn't the case at the state level. I'm not sure what explains that trend, but it was one that definitely surprised me to see that there are states that have said Chevron, but not our. Other states defer only to certain types of agency actions. A couple of states, California and Oregon, there is Georgia has really one of the states that has, I think, made this very clear. They have, in a recent decision, said after using all tools of construction, there are few statutes or regulations that are truly ambiguous, and very strongly suggested that there will almost never be an opportunity for deference because of that. Because the judiciary can do the work to interpret statutes, and rarely will there be a really ambiguous statute after you apply all canons of interpretation. The Texas Supreme Court has also done this very strongly, engaged in very elaborate statutory review, and rather than employing deference. So that's a very encouraging trend among a couple states. I think that's the same trend we're seeing at the U.S. Supreme Court and federal courts, really seeing an emphasis on rigorous statutory interpretation and review rather than what happened in the past, which was, this is ambiguous, we can't figure it out very quickly, so we are going to defer. So that's a very encouraging trend. And in addition to that, there are several states where there are very strong voices of dissent on the courts. I'll highlight Ohio. There are several justices, at least three members of the Ohio Supreme Court, that have expressed very sharp skepticism of deference. Justice Kennedy, Justice DeWine, and Justice Stewart of that court. Justice Kennedy emphasized that deference is an abdication of the court's judicial duty and authority. And he emphasized that deferring would be abandoning the court's role as an independent check for the executive branch. Other members of that court have been very sharp as well. The Georgia Supreme Court is actually a court that's, I think, very close to abolishing deference. In 2019, they actually granted certiorari to determine deference is, quote, in tension with our role as the principal interpreter of Georgia law. But the court in that case that they granted cert on decided ultimately that the regulation in question was not ambiguous and therefore did not resolve the question of whether deference would go on. And as I mentioned earlier, it then emphasized the need for a very extensive statutory review. So in the combination of both having this rigorous review and strong voices of dissent on the court, it seems likely that Georgia is one of the states that will hopefully move away from deference in the next couple of years. Then it's worth mentioning that there is a large category of states that are, I would call, very inconsistent in their application of deference. One, the tales that is very unfortunate is the Indiana Supreme Court. In 2018, the court issued a very strong decision. It really seemed like rejecting deference completely. They said the separation of powers principles do not contemplate a tie goes to the agency standard for reviewing administrative decisions on questions of law. And they emphasized their constitutional duty to decide what the law is. It seemed like a very strong rebuke. Unfortunately, the next year, the court walked this back. The author of that opinion in 2018 wrote a very sharp dissent explaining that he said he had thought this discredited standard, which the court resurrects today, had been laid to rest for good, and that there was no principled reason consistent with powers for according fundamentally different treatment to the statutory interpretation of different agencies within the branch of state government. And unfortunately, the other members of the court basically walked it back and said that case, but in other cases when it's appropriate, we will defer. So worth watching Indiana to see if what direction they go in. There's definitely a very sharp voice for abolition of deference, and other members of the court have pushed back on that. Highlight one or two inconsistent states, because I think that it really shows how all over the map some of these states are. And South Dakota is one of the most inconsistent states. South Dakota has declared that it grants no deference to agency interpretations, but in one very recent decision from 2017 decision, the court cited Chevron, the federal Chevron case, and declared, quote, the same analysis applies here. And then another decision from the South Dakota Supreme Court goes so far as to suggest that agency interpretations must be upheld if the interpretation is reasonable. Other decisions suggest that deference only applies when an agency is given express statutory authority to interpret a statute. And you really define the decision from the South Dakota Supreme Court that fits in every category that I've talked about so far. So the only conclusion I can safely draw is that South Dakota rarely defers to administrative agencies except when it does. And it's very hard to tell when it's going to do so. Similarly, I think that to my mind, the word for the most incoherent and incompatible body precedent has to go to Nevada. Within the past few years, the Nevada Supreme Court has issued decisions expressly saying that agencies are entitled to no deference at all, and other decisions saying that agencies are entitled to great deference. And I cannot reconcile those two at all. My best sense, having spoken to a couple of Nevada attorneys about this question, is that there is some agencies get deference, others don't, but it's not, no one knows which ones, and it's not stated anywhere which ones are going to get deference. I challenge anyone, if anyone knows anything about Nevada law, it seems like that court has to, in the next, hopefully in the next couple of years, reconcile these decisions and issue a decision on whether deference will continue in the state and in what context. Finally, I want to note that the states that do have full deference, I have 12 states that still defer completely in line with Chevron or our deference. There are a couple things interesting to note about those states. First of all, at least in some of them, broader anti-regulatory or anti-administrative state trends might already be living back to deference. In Idaho, in the past few years, there's been a very broad anti-regulatory agenda, which includes requiring all regulations to be considered and reauthorized by the state every year. And so it's not clear whether deference really has a meaningful place anymore in Idaho, or whether there's actually any deference being given to agencies in Idaho, because if the legislator is ratifying every year what the agency does, and really it's more deference to the legislator, except in the initial year before a regulation is ratified. So Idaho, there's a question whether there's any meaningful ground still for deference, even though courts have not repudiated it, there's no legislation, but there might just be no room anymore for deference given the structure that has come about in the past couple of years. And so even in this category of states that defer, it seems to me that looking at cases that there is a trend towards more rigorous interpretation of statutes. For instance, the Alabama Supreme Court emphasized that, quote, it will, quote, not blindly follow an administrative agency's interpretation, but will interpret the statute to mean exactly what it says. So they haven't gone as far, I think, as some of the other states in questioning deference or emphasizing that they're not going to defer. But there are quite a few states that have rigorously applied tentative interpretation. Seems like a very positive trend in that direction. One other point is that there unfortunately seem to be quite a few states that have not fully thought carefully about justifications for deference. They go back and forth on their justifications or don't really explain it at all. I didn't see many states where there is a well thought out defense of deference that really has grappled with deference and really come out explaining deference. So I think there's a lot of room for even the states that are going to keep deferring to really thoroughly examine the question of why are we deferring. For the states that have done so, I think the best explanation that states come up with is the recognition that agencies have specialized expertise. And it seems like that's the primary rationale at the state level compared to the federal level, where there are some other rationales that maybe dominate, like the need for uniformity among the federal courts of appeal. That rationale clearly doesn't apply to the state level. And so really the dominating rationale seems to be the expertise rationale. And finally, final point I wanted to highlight is I've talked about states in this call so far, but I do want to note that there's also a similar debate going on at federal in territories and among Indian tribes. The Virgin Islands Supreme Court in 2014 and the Guam Supreme Court, to a lesser degree, have rejected or questioned pale deference. On the other hand, the Puerto Rico Supreme Court has deferred to agencies on an expertise rationale and rejected calls to abolish deference. And there's a similar debate going on in tribal courts. So this is not just a state issue, but also a federal and territorial issue. And to sum up, these trends are dramatic. They're quite sustained. Many states are moving in this direction. I couldn't identify any states moving toward deference, but a lot of states that have gotten rid of deference or abolished it. And it's a really encouraging trend that I think we will see continue over the next couple of years.
But we'll now open up the floor for audience Q&A. We'll now go to our first question.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Alexandria Suarez. I'm an attorney down in Homestead, Florida, and I've focused more on provider defense with administrative hearings. And my question is whether, and thank you, first of all, because it's very informative, and it's a relief to know that some states are at least recognizing that great deference of agencies' rules is infringing on the judicial checks and balances. And a lot of people don't realize it. But my question is whether ACCA, or if you know of anything related to healthcare, whether those agencies, if there's any changes to that great deference rule, if it's being looked at in at a federal level, or if anything that's an update as far as the great deference that's given to agencies, including ACCA. I watched, just for way of background, in South Florida, I watched the decimation of our healthcare down here, with providers having to close shop because they had no bargaining power with audits. So any Medicaid overpayment, Medicare review, because of that great deference doctrine, they didn't stand a chance, and a lot of them closed up shop.
I mean, I think it's worth highlighting, you know, deference really does have consequences for businesses that are being burdened by regulatory burdens that the legislator has never really enacted, and agencies are just adopting them and taking on burdens and being given deference. I think at the federal level, there are, as I mentioned, judges that have called for reforming or abolishing deference. There have been some very sharp concurrences and dissents, but I don't think that there is yet an appetite at the Supreme Court for a dramatic curtailing of especially Chevron deference. I do think that the moral case can be made. So one of the things I think states are worth studying is, if you look at what's happening in state levels, you know, states are laboratories for democracy. They allow us to test out different policies and see which ones work and what the impact is. And so I think that the state experiment with abolishing deference will show judges and lawyers and advocates and scholars that you can get rid of deference, and it doesn't destroy the administrative state. It doesn't mean the agencies can't function. It doesn't mean that they're always going to lose. It just means that it shifts the balance, the battlefield, the playing field, that levels it for litigants. You know, it means that those who are the most powerful advocates in the country, the most frequent advocates, don't get to decide what the law means. So I think that the state experiment will hopefully, my hope is, impact the debate about federal deference and lead courts and maybe even the legislature, you know, Congress, to take action about recognizing that there aren't going to be really negative consequences. You know, states have done this, even large states, and you haven't seen things fall apart. The states can still function. The agencies still can make rules and enforce them, but it just makes the playing field more level. So I hope that that's going to be the impact on the federal level, is that people are going to realize, yes, we can make reform. No, it's not going to destroy the administrative state, but it is going to be a meaningful reform for liberty and for individuals.
All right. No other questions in the queue as of now. In the meantime, Daniel, I also wanted to ask how you think how this analysis you've given us today, how that ties into Chevron and our deference here in D.C., sort of on the national level.
Yeah, so it kind of goes a little bit related to what I was just saying. I think that there's a lot that we can learn from what the states are doing. I think hopefully courts, federal courts, and legislators elsewhere will see, you know, we can make meaningful reform. This is not destroying the ability of agencies to regulate. It's not going to the death of the state, of the administrative state, although that wouldn't be the worst thing if it was curtailed significantly, but it's not going to destroy their ability to function. But it is going to instead just limit their ability to take advantage of regulated parties to adopt right interpretations that are less reasonable or more arbitrary, or that a reasonable interpretation of the statute would not have predicted, and to instead give individuals the ability to fight back and offer what they think is the best interpretation of the law. I do hope that you might even see states going in the opposite direction of adopting a presumption of liberty or a presumption against agency interpretations, to say if there is a reasonable ambiguity that exists about the proper interpretation, the courts should instead adopt the interpretation that is most promoting the liberty, least beneficial to agency action. I think that would be a big departure from the status quo, but I'm hoping that we'll see some states experiment with that in the next couple of years to see if that works as well.
All right. And we do have a question in the queue. Before I go to that question, I just want to offer up a brief reminder to keep an eye out for Teleform call announcement emails. They go out during the week to announce our future calls. We also have the full schedule on the Federalist Society website. And our next Teleform call is actually going to be coming up later this afternoon at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and it's going to be on the Chinese government's record of human rights, and it's going to be marking the June 4th anniversary of Tiananmen Square. With that, we'll then go to our next question.
Yeah, this is Charles Grinnell in Stamford, Connecticut. Would you say that there is some authority for the proposition that the amount of deference that a state court, will lend to an administrative agency is really directly proportional to the expertise of the agency? For example, at the federal level, the allocation of radio frequencies is probably not something the court is particularly going to get into. That's sort of maybe a social service agency the court will get into. Mm. Something highly technical involving engineering, maybe they won't. But is there any line of cases or support for that thought? Thank you.
Yes, I think there are at least seven states that use that as a metric. Alaska, Iowa, New Mexico, New York, North Dakota, Virginia, and Washington all, to some degree or another, have decisions saying, if the agency's decisions are highly technical or are specialized, we are going to defer. On the other hand, if they are not, if all they're doing is interpreting statutory terms that are common to the judiciary, what is the mens rea, what is the standard of proof, common legal concepts that the courts deal with all the time, they say we're not going to defer. I think that you comment actually raises one important point I wanted to make, which is these state policies, which are lesser than Chevron or limited in some way, present a possibility for how Chevron could be reformed at the federal level. You could make an argument that makes sense as a policy, that if something is highly technical or specialized, it make more sense to have agencies have to get deference. On the other hand, if it's just interpreting a terminology that anyone could really understand and the judiciary could interpret just as well as the agency, then you should not defer. So there are quite a few states that have done so. It does seem like a common argument that the courts have adopted, and I think it is one that has potential as a way to limit Chevron and limit our... It's consistent with the original explanation the court gave for why they would defer in Chevron, or at least one of the main explanations, again, which is that agency expertise, that idea that there's something specialized that agencies have that the courts do not have. And so I think it makes sense to say when the courts have that now on an equal level, the agencies, it's interpreting a statutory term, which is a legal term of art. There is no reason to say agencies have some expertise when they don't. And so I think that's a sensible reform to Chevron that makes a lot of sense.
All right. We have a few other questions in the queue. We'll move to our next question now.
Hi there. This is Larry Schnaff. Is there a list somewhere of the states that follow Chevron that I could look up?
Sure. Yeah, I have an article. It's up on SSRN. I don't know if there's a way to email it or send it to those that are on the list, but it's on SSRN. It's called the same title as the name of this teleforum, The End of Deference, How States and Territories Are Leading a Sometimes Quiet Revolution Against Administrative Deference Doctrines. It should be up on SSRN right now. And in there, there's at the end of the article, There is a list of all the states by category and a map with the state color-coded. I also did a couple blog posts on the notice and comment blog that Yale Journal of Regulation runs, and that on there have that map as well, the color-coded map.
So okay, great.
Same title of the article on end of deference on the notice and comment blog. You can find it there as well.
We'll now move to our next caller in the queue.
Hi, Dave Rigdon with in Carson City, Nevada. You mentioned, Daniel, and by the way, great presentation, but you mentioned that in Nevada it seemed to be somewhat unclear. I was just curious about that. We practice and litigate against a particular state agency here, and in the last couple of years, we've gotten some pretty good opinions from the Supreme Court, at least with respect to this particular state agency, that seem to indicate that you know, district courts are supposed to review questions of law de novo, and while the state agency's interpretation of the statute may be persuasive, it doesn't relieve the court of the obligation of reviewing that interpretation on a de novo basis and rendering its own decision. And we found the district courts in the state, the state district courts, to be particularly open to that idea. So I was just curious about your comment about how it's kind of an open question still.
Yeah, that's encouraging. What's the agency that you've been litigating against, if I could ask?
It's the Division of Water Resources. It deals with water rights and water issues.
Yeah, excellent. Well, my sense is I spoke to another Nevada attorney and his about this question, and his understanding was there are certain agencies, especially the Department of Health and Human Services, is the one that came up that he brought up that still receive deference. Specifically, anything has to do with public health would be maybe the common tread if I had to pick one based on the cases I've seen. But so to quote, you know, it's a 2018 case from the Nevada Supreme Court, they said, finally, we must afford great deference to the department's interpretation of a statute that is tasked with enforcing when the interpretation does not conflict with the plain language of the statute or legislative intent. So a pretty standard statement of deference, but that's from 2018. On the other hand, I found a case from 2019 saying that this are persuasive, but not until the deference. And I think that was from the state engineers. So kind of similar to what you're talking about of, you know, water rights issue. So I think it just depends on the agency, it seems like. I think there really does need to be, hopefully, a case up to the Nevada Supreme Court asking for clarification on this matter. If you have any thoughts about where that might come from, I'd be very interested to hear from you. Maybe you could reach out to me after this call. I'd love to discuss that with you further.
All right. And just another reminder, too, if anybody has questions at the end of the call, if you want to get in contact with the speaker or access to an article or anything like that, like we just had, feel free to reach out to info@fedsoc.org with the telephone name and the subject line. And we'll try and facilitate that as best we can.
Great.
And we've reached the end of our question queue, so I'll offer out one more call for questions. If anyone has a question of our speaker today, just press star and then pound. While we're waiting to see if a question comes through, Daniel, is there anything else you wanted to cover before closing remarks today?
I think we've covered everything, but I do want to emphasize, you know, that there is a lot of potential here for additional states to make action to abolish deference. There are quite a few states, for instance, that signed on to an amicus brief from the states in the Kaiser case, urging the Supreme Court to get rid of Seminole Rock or Auer deference, that still have deference or in the state courts employ Seminole Rock or Auer deference. So there are states that, you know, or there are other states that still have a Republican trifecta, you know, conservative control of all branches of government, but still have deference. There are quite a few states that fit in that category. So I think there's a lot of potential for reform there. There's a potential for reform in the courts that have voices of dissent on the court, especially ones like Ohio, where there are significant multiple members of the Supreme Court. So I would urge those who are litigants to raise these arguments, urge the courts to decide them. Don't be afraid to say, look, all these other states are doing this, are reconsidering deference. You should do so as well. Bring the arguments to courts and let them actually resolve the issue. And that will, I think, be maybe a very positive step in the end of, towards the end of deference.
Wonderful. And actually, we did have one more question pop in, so we'll go ahead and fit another caller in before we close today.
Good afternoon. I thought it was an interesting presentation. My name is Charlie Carter. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm going to offer a contrarian view here because I think there's been too much of a push to believe that Chevron, for example, is some sort of an evil result. I was on the EPA brief in the Chevron case in the Supreme Court, and I think folks need to be reminded of why we were there and what the Supreme Court was overruling in with respect to the D.C. Circuit at that time. That circuit had basically decided it could run both EPA and pretty much any other agency better than the agency could, and were substituting their views for the views of the agency. And it gotten completely out of hand. Chevron was the third in line of three Supreme Court cases. There was a State Farm case, I've forgotten what the third one was, in which they finally said, look, you did, guys, you need to get it. You don't run these agencies. It's for the agencies to make their own decisions. So while there may be some cases where Chevron deference has gone too far, and I've seen some cases that I didn't entirely agree with as well, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here. I think there should be a middle ground here that we can come to. Where agencies at least deserve some degree of deference, if not, you know, wholesale.
Yeah. Well, I think two things I would say. One is I think that the line of Skidmore deference is a more sensible line in my mind, where you say, well, to the degree that what the agency says is persuasive, if they're relying on very extensive studies, if they're doing work that the courts can't do, that's a situation where they receive greater deference or greater appreciation for their interpretations. I think another thing to say would be, there's difference between policy judgments and decisions and statutory interpretation. When you're deciding what do the words of a statute mean, ultimately, I would say that argue that is for the judiciary to do. If you're talking about what policy to adopt, then that should be Congress, or to what degree that they can defer or delegate to the agencies. You know, the agencies should be able to do that. But I do think courts did go far in saying, we can't decide exactly what the statute means, therefore we're going to leave it up to the agency to decide. I don't think that's compatible with the rule of law. So I would agree with Justice Thomas and other judges that have really questioned the ability, whether that's consistent with the idea that the judiciary gets to interpret the law. I do think there is a middle ground. I think we shouldn't go too far to say, well, agencies don't get to make any decisions at all. But I do think the courts with Chevron went too far in the direction of deference.
Well, let me make a further point here, which is it's one thing to say courts should interpret statutory terms. That makes a fair bit of sense if it's some sort of common term. But in the case in the Chevron case, we're talking about the Clean Air Act, a very technical statute that the court has no expertise in, and yet it was substituting its judgment for the agency's interpretation of very specific technical terms in the statute. So I think you're pushing the envelope just a bit too far to say an agency shouldn't be have some deference or at least ability to interpret the statute and not be overridden by a court just because the court says, oh yeah, no, we think it ought to go a different way.
Yeah. I would say there's a big difference also between some deference and controlling deference, which Chevron gives, controlling deference to the agency's interpretation that says if the agency interpretation, if it's ambiguous, then we're not going to decide what is the best interpretation. We're going to just say the agency's interpretation gets controlling weight. I think there is a lot of middle ground closer to what Skidmore deference offered, which says if the agency is offering a good or the best interpretation, we will give them extra weight, or if they've specialized knowledge or expertise, or they have a highly technical interpretation, we're going to be more likely to defer to that. Even under Skidmore deference, most courts were deferring largely to agencies. Agencies still win most of these cases because they have put the thought in, they have put the effort in, and usually their decisions, their interpretations are reasonable and are well-grounded. So I think the impact of getting rid of deference will, by and large, be less dramatic than you think, and I think that it can be shown through the states that have experimented with getting rid of deference.
All right. Well, Dan, you sort of closed out with your previous ones, but I'll offer you another chance. Is there anything you'd like to say or closing remarks before we close out today?
Sure. Just I think that these changes have been very dramatic, very noticeable, very encouraging, in my opinion. I think courts have really across the country recognized that they have an obligation to be interpreting the law, that they deference interferes with that function. I'm really encouraged by these trends, and I hope to see many more states embracing that. I think it's up to us as litigants to raise these arguments and to advance the ball towards the end of deference in the states and in the federal courts.
All right. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.